This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Are you driving your car or doing laundry right now? Podcasts go best when they're bundled with another activity. Like Progressive home and auto policies, they're best when they're bundled too. Having these two policies together makes insurance easier and could help you save. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. Quote a home and car bundle today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Observatory straight up the block to West Boulevard and make that right.
They didn't break that, but they have pretty good access to those people.
Actually, her image subconsciously mocks that lineage. But she's
so that's happening.
It seems like an incredible story here on many fronts.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. When the drug OxyContin first came into the market in 1995, it was advertised as a breakthrough, an opioid that would manage pain better and would actually reduce the potential for addiction. But just two decades later, OxyContin is a name that's become almost infamous in American life as the opioid crisis reaches truly awful proportions. The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe has been reporting on Purdue Pharma, the company that developed OxyContin, and the Sackler family, which controls it. One of the people Patrick spoke with was a man named Stephen May, an insider who saw exactly how the company's marketing worked. May is a former sales rep for Purdue, and he started there in 1999 as sales of OxyContin were booming.
Tell me, for starters, how did you first come to get into pharmaceutical sales?
Well, actually, I had a neighbor that lived near me back in the late 90s who was a pharmaceutical sales representative, and I saw that he had a really successful career, and, you know, it was something that I personally wanted to get into. I mean, I knew that the economic benefit was pretty good, so he helped me to get in with his company, which I did in 1998, and started working for a company that actually sold a combination opioid. I was in the market of Purdue. So I was very familiar with the OxyContin product before even joining Purdue, and knowing the growth that they were having when there was an opportunity to join, you know, what was perceived to be the best company to work for in the industry. I basically jumped at it.
And where were you exactly? Like, what region were you in?
I was basically covering southwestern Virginia and parts of southern West Virginia.
I see. And were there were certain kind of marketing, I know that in some of the early marketing campaigns, what they would say is that OxyContin was the drug to start with and to stay with. Did you hear that when you were there?
Oh, I use that quite frequently. Yeah, start with and stay with. So basically, the idea is this. You've got a physician that is prescribing a lot of Lortab or Vicodin, and those are the combination opiates with hydrocodone or Percocet or oxycodone that the patient is taking every 4 to 6 hours. Well, doctor, if you recognize early on that they're going to have to take an opiate, why not just go ahead and start them on 10 milligrams of OxyContin twice a day instead of getting into that habit forming, you know, 4 or 6 times a day? So you could start with a low dose 10 milligrams. If you think about it, 10 milligrams delivered over a period of 12 hours is the same or even less than if a patient took, you know, 5 milligrams of hydrocodone or Percocet every 4 or 6 hours. And at the same time, you're not getting that peak and then that trough and then that peak and then that trough. It's basically a much smoother delayed absorption of the product over a period of 12 hours.
But that's so fascinating. So actually, part of the sale for you guys was that OxyContin might be less prone to addiction and abuse than other drugs.
Yeah, I think the word that was used more often would be habit-forming in that case.
I see.
You know, it's habit-forming to use something every 4 hours as opposed to 12 hours.
Yeah, though I mean, using, you can use something every 12 hours and have it be a habit as well.
Exactly.
But when you were talking to those physicians, did you get the sense that some of them might be prescribing the drug more frequently, like on a more frequent dosing schedule to their patients?
Yeah, I mean, you would have doctors tell you that they were doing that. And what was absolutely crucial as a sales rep to protect your own job, to, you know, is, well, you have to promote the product according to the label. I mean, we're talking about class two medications here. You can get in a lot of trouble. So it was always trying to get the doctor back to, hey, listen, this is a 12-hour drug. I know you said that your patients need to take it, you know, three times a day every 8 hours, but it's a 12-hour drug. That's the way it's supposed to be prescribed.
And when they told you that in some instances maybe the patients needed it three times a day and they would be prescribing it as that, did it strike you at all that that's – that if that was what was happening, then the whole kind of marketing thrust that you only needed it twice a day might not actually be true?
It's possible, yes. At the same time, we would also instruct the doctor if they're having to take it every 8 hours versus every 12 hours, perhaps the patient needs to be titrated upwards on the drug to a higher dose.
I see. And so they would take it just twice a day but with a higher dose each time.
Exactly. Exactly. That would be the appropriate thing to do.
Gotcha. I mean, it's interesting. So you're going in there, you're meeting with doctors, you're showing them literature to support the drug. But you're not a doctor, right? You're not a clinician. How comfortable were you with the science of it? I mean, did you have to kind of prepare in advance for questions that you might get from the doctors and know what types of answers you would give them?
Well, that's part of the training that we go to. We spend 3 weeks literally not only learning about the product itself, but you learn about the background of the product. In this case, it was pain management. We learn about the history of pain management. And then you spend a lot of time going through common objections that the doctors would give you.
What kinds of common objections?
Well, I mean, I guess the most common objection that I heard after joining the company was, well, it's just too addictive. I mean, we've got too many problems in our community with, you know, overdose deaths. And so basically, a lot of time was spent trying to overcome the doctor's objections on that and trying to refocus them and saying, you know, yes, there's going to be people out there that are going to abuse or divert the drug. But basically, we were trained, let's focus on treating the legitimate pain patients, you know. And if we can focus on treating those patients, then we'll have the outcomes and the doctors will prescribe the products.
Well, this is another thing I wanted to ask you about is, so you go out there and the first and biggest objection that you're encountering is, well, geez, you know, aren't these things really addictive? Did you believe that they weren't? Was the company telling you that they weren't? Were there studies or was there data that you could give to doctors to say, no, actually, you've got it wrong. This isn't addictive?
Well, I mean, early on, one of the biggest things that I would use, I mean, I memorized the specific line in the package insert that was later changed by the FDA, and that was the delayed absorption of the OxyContin was believed to reduce the abuse liability of the drug. You know, that was one of the things that we're trying to express to physicians. Now, that I think that worked for a while, but it wasn't very long into my experience with the company that, well, if they crush up the medication, then that kind of destroys the long-acting delivery system. So, well,
because people were crushing the pills and snorting them or injecting them,
melting them, exactly. So there was ways to get around that, and eventually, I think the FDA changed the labeling of that, and at some point, we were told that we could no longer use that particular language.
So let me understand this. So you get recruited to go work at Purdue Pharma, which has this super elite sales force. It's got this blockbuster product. They're paying better than a lot of other pharmaceutical companies are. And then you actually get down there on the ground, and it sounds like already there's blowback because in the communities, people realize that there's abuse and addiction. So, I mean, that must have been kind of disillusioning for you, I would think.
It was. I mean, I started seeing it early on. One of my experiences was I had, I think at the time, it was a representative who was either the previous national sales rep of the year or they were on track to becoming the national sales representative of the year. So they would come in to help train us, to watch them handle objections from physicians. So we went into a doctor's office in West Virginia and, you know, we were pulled aside and advised that a family member of that particular doctor had died over as a result of an overdose of OxyContin. So that was a pretty significant blow that we both had. So I call that the day that it really hit really close to home for me. And, you know.
And what year was that roughly?
Oh, that was within a month or two after me joining with the company. In 2000, yeah.
And you stayed on for another 5 years.
Yes.
So what did you tell yourself? I mean, did you think these were just isolated incidents or?
You know, quite frankly, I mean, what do you tell yourself? I mean, you really believe that you're doing a righteous duty by trying to treat pain, you know, and you're trying to focus, trying to get physicians on using the product for legitimate pain patients to use the product the right way. I mean, that was my personal focus. And at the same time, it was still a good company to work for. There was more and more challenges. You know, I think we really, as a company, first started seeing the challenges in West Virginia and Southern West Virginia and parts of what anybody calls Appalachia. But you really feel like you're doing something good. And at the same time, you're recognizing that, hey, look, this is a company that I could work for a long time. They're going to have other products down the road. So you stay with it for that reason, because there's an opportunity for personal growth.
I see. And were you feeling pressure from the company to keep growing the territory?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was, you know, how do we turn the doctors' minds away from the bad news of what was happening in the community and get them focused on treating the legitimate chronic pain patients? So, yeah, there was a constant push on that.
And you eventually were part of a whistleblower lawsuit against Purdue, is that right?
That's correct.
But it got dismissed.
Yeah, it was dismissed. I mean, it had been in the court system for many years. It's not hard for anybody to look up any information about it. It's Radcliffe May v. Purdue. We had specific allegations that the company had committed fraud, and eventually it was dismissed on a technicality.
It was a procedural basis for dismissing it.
That's my understanding, Kurt.
Looking back now, a lot of observers feel that while there are obviously a bunch of companies that make prescription painkillers, which are abused, that Purdue Pharma played kind of an instrumental, special role in precipitating the opioid crisis, because the company pushed really aggressively to destigmatize the long-term use of strong opioids. How do you feel looking back? I mean, do you feel as though Purdue has any culpability in getting us to where we are today and in the opioid crisis?
Well, I believe they were absolutely instrumental in it. The culpability is you can't turn a blind eye to the problems that you're creating in the community. And that's one of the things I want to say to the Sackler family. Stand up. Be responsible. Be proud of your company. Okay, you built a great company. But also take some responsibility for the problems that has been caused by the way that your products were being promoted and how your products were being abused. And at the same time, you're still pushing the promotion of that product that's destroying communities today. I mean, I can't say it any other way. Be accountable.
And is there any sense in which you on a personal level look back and feel any guilt or feel any as though you personally have any culpability?
All I think as an individual, you're doing your job. You believe that you're doing it righteously. You don't want to do wrong. You want to help people. At the same time, looking back, you go, wow, perhaps I probably should have resigned from the company early on and just walked away from a situation that was growing bad. But at the same time, you look, what was the information that I had at the time? Was there a way to turn this thing around? At the time, I believe there was. But looking back, it saddens me that I was a part of it. I'll say it that way.
That was Stephen May, a former sales rep for Purdue Pharma, talking with The New Yorker's Patrick Radden Keefe. Patrick just published a piece in The New Yorker called Empire of Pain about the selling of OxyContin. Now, Patrick, we just heard Stephen May lay blame for the consequences of opioid addictions on the Sackler family. The fact that Purdue is privately held by the descendants of two brothers, how has that affected how it does business now?
Well, it's a very secret company. It always has been. If this was a publicly traded pharmaceutical company, you'd have shareholders, you'd have earnings calls, you'd have quarterly reports, and there would be a check, a kind of an outside check. But really, this company is the kind of private realm of this one family, and they own it, they control it. They're on the board. The profits all flow to the family. And what this means is when you get into some of these dicey questions about selling a very addictive substance to lots and lots of people, what may be complicated ethical questions that normally you would be able to subject to a kind of a larger review in a publicly traded company, really they're just decided by the family. And we don't know what goes into that decision-making.
What do you think is ahead for the Sackler family? Do you think they face investigation, whether it's congressional or law enforcement?
Well, they've been incredibly successful over the years at distancing themselves from the company that has made them all this money. So this is a family that, according to Forbes, is worth about $14 billion. And a lot of people don't necessarily realize the connection. They just know that there are these nice, wealthy people that they meet in New York or in London who give money to museums and universities.
Right. Their name is plastered all over any number of museum wings and buildings and all the rest, and yet not so much on the—
Not on the company.
No.
This is a family that has a kind of a mania for putting their name on things. My favorite example of this is if you go to the Tate Modern in London, there is a Sackler escalator, an escalator named after the Sackler family. But if you go to the website of Purdue Pharma, the company that they own, which is really the source of most of their wealth in recent decades, you can search and search, and it'll take you a while to actually find the Sackler name.
What do you think their defense will be?
David, I've wondered about that, and I thought to myself, you know, there might be a kind of libertarian case that could be made, which is essentially in the same way that if you own a firearms company, right? Well, we put a product out there in the world. It's dangerous if used incorrectly, but ultimately this is a question of individual responsibility.
A libertarian argument in the world of pharmaceuticals?
Can you imagine?
We're seeing a staggering tragic number of deaths from overdoses because of this epidemic, especially from heroin, which is deadly and very cheap on the street. OxyContin is legal, and it's regulated. So why is it such a problem?
Well, here's the answer. For thousands of years, people have cultivated poppies. And we've known about the therapeutic benefits of opium-related narcotics. We've also known for thousands of years that they're really addictive. And this has always been the two sides of the coin. When Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family set out to sell OxyContin, what they wanted to do was destigmatize strong opioids. The whole idea was, we've got doctors out there who are reluctant to prescribe these. How do we change their minds? And they set out to change their minds. And they were incredibly effective. So the real issue with the heroin is that once the country is flooded with these opioids, you get a lot of people getting addicted. And once that genie is out of the bottle, it gets very hard to put it back. So Purdue Pharma, other companies, have tried to prevent their pills in more recent years from going to the black market, from getting crushed, from being abused. But it's kind of too late. And in an awful paradox, the harder it gets for somebody who's already addicted to opioids in 2017 to get access through their doctor to opioids, the more likely it is that they're going to be buying them on the street. It may be too expensive, and they end up buying heroin, which is cheaper. And this is where we get the spike in heroin
use. Did the Sackler family make any efforts to right a wrong?
Well, they would tell you that they did, in that Purdue Pharma reformulated OxyContin in 2010, making it harder to crush and snort. But I talked to people who said, you really have to look at the timing of this, because they reformulated OxyContin in 2010, but the patent on the drug was set to expire in 2013. This is something you actually typically find in the life cycle of a branded narcotic, is just as the exclusive patent is about to expire, you tweak the formula in some way so as to make it seem that much different. And then what happens is you reset the clock on your exclusive right to produce it. So they would tell you they had. What's interesting is if you look at their philanthropy, this is a family that gives to cancer research, they give to medical schools, they give to art museums, universities. There's nothing for the opioid crisis, nothing for addiction treatment. If there is any sense in that family that they bear any moral culpability for where we are today, they're not acting on it.
Patrick, it's an astonishing piece of journalism. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Patrick Radden Keefe is a staff writer at The New Yorker, and you can find his article, Empire of Pain, at newyorkerradio.org.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Jill Duboff, Karen Frillman, David Krasnow, Sarah Nix, Michael Raphael, Mythili Rao, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Susan Morrison, Emma Allen, Sarah Sandbach, and Jessica Henderson. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.